You're listening to Double Take, critical, sometimes confrontational, but always amusing conversations about movies. Double Take is a Cinema Classics production and is produced by Johnny DiLoretto and John DeSando. I'm Johnny DiLoretto.
I'm John DeSando.
We got a double take.
We do.
What's the first? Take one. What's take one?
Take one is a big whale, 52.
Okay.
And that's the number of hertz.
So we're talking about documentaries.
And we're talking documentaries. Right, yeah, yeah. And then the other part of that is Anthony Bourdain, the Roadrunner.
Yeah.
Yeah, all right. Okay. So we're looking at those. And then we're going to talk about documentaries in general.
Okay. So, I hope you came prepared because I know very little about documentaries.
Oh, and I researched a bit for in my memory and online. Yes.
Okay,
so
terrific.
I'm a bit prepared.
So these two movies, these two new documentaries,
yeah.
52... The Loneliest Whale on Earth, I think, is the full title.
Yeah.
And then Roadrunner, which is a remembrance and celebration of Chef Anthony Bourdain.
Right.
One of these is much better than the other, but they are both sort of Moby Dickian in their pursuit.
Nice.
In their pursuit of the unfindable, the unanswerable.
Now, that's great. That's a really good connection.
Yeah, you're welcome. In Roadrunner, we're after, I don't know, the essence of Anthony Bourdain. We're left with a lot. It's a lot of talking heads.
Yeah.
Intercut with, you know, a lot of footage, a lot of video footage going way back.
Oh, yeah. And
prior to his.
All about him.
Bestseller, Kitchen Confidential.
Yeah, yeah. The documentary itself shows how overpowering he is. Kind of like the LeBron James of food,
yeah,
right? You know, just dominates everything. He's the best, but he's the best performer about food.
For
he's
sure.
He's not necessarily the best chef.
Yeah, he was never considered a great chef.
Yeah.
It was really his book, Kitchen Confidential, that opened a window onto that industry that hadn't been, or pulled the curtain back, rather, that hadn't been done before. What I really love about him, and it took me a long time to warm up to him because I just didn't like his. There was something off-putting.
Well,
about
arrogant.
Him. He is arrogant.
Yeah,
but there was something about him that eventually kind of drew me in. And what I realized in this documentary, what it was, is because he was always kind of questioning his right to be where he was.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? His right to be famous. His right to be heralded as a great writer or as a great cook. And I love that about him. And I love this, what seems to have driven him was this idea that I'm not going to do it that way. I'm not going to do it the way it's always been done. You know, like writing a book, right? It wasn't about the restaurant industry as this great thing. You know, it was about, hey, here's all the gross, dirty things you've never really considered that's going on there. There was always this sort of insouciant kind of take on the world.
Oh yeah, and he was a buccaneer. He was roguish. He didn't take the industry seriously, other than that he took his celebrity very seriously. Mm. And I think that this documentary shows.
But he took it seriously in a way that he was connecting with people.
Well,
he knew people wanted to connect.
But
with him.
At the same time, I think it showed him to be an enormous egotist or egoist.
Mm, okay.
Didn't necessarily have to talk about himself, but he was definitely self-centered. A man who used his charm, his magnetism, to make his way around the world. And he went around the world, the best metaphor being that he never found himself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what the documentary does really good for me is that I'm sitting there all the time saying, maybe this is going to tell me why he committed suicide.
Yeah.
You know, built into this documentary, a kind of perverse interest.
It's just, I'm laughing because of all, not because of the suicide, which is really tragic, but because you said both, keeps on searching for himself. Right?
Yes.
That's the central premise of the documentary, Anthony Bourdain's search for self.
Yes.
Whereas we as the viewers, as the spectators of the film, are seeking this answer about why did he kill himself?
Yes.
And then I keep thinking about 52.
All right.
And this search for this whale.
Yes.
Right? And this whale is so alone. And so this whale, you know, they go into the movie. One of the more fascinating, successful aspects of the movie is the examination of the whale song. you know, as a cultural phenomenon, as a marine biological phenomenon.
Yes.
What do whale songs mean?
Yes.
Why are we so?
Yes.
They argue that whale songs are what kind of helped halt the whaling industry, because people finally could connect to these, you know, magnificent mammals.
And you're pointing up one of the central interests for me in that 52.
Yeah.
Is that it's all about communication. We're trying to communicate. We're trying to catch, get a hold of, understand that whale.
Mm-hmm.
The whale is trying to communicate.
Right. And that's what we should say the title is about, 52. This whale is singing at 52 hertz, which I guess is too low. And it's not getting any response from any other whales.
Yeah.
So when they look at whale songs, they can see hundreds of miles away these sound waves travel through the water. That's the other interesting thing.
Yeah.
And they'll be answered by other whales. And yet, this whale calling out at 52 hertz is met with a deafening oceanic silence.
And one of the problems with 52 is that they never really capture the whale. And they talk about it in a couple of seconds.
They're talking about looking for one whale in the ocean.
And they never did get it. They never get it. They can tell me in the end that they did. I don't believe them.
You're spoiling this movie.
It's a documentary. They can look it up anytime and see that they...
You know what? It does pose an exciting cinematic conundrum, right? The filmmaker says, look, I am compelled to find this whale. For whatever reason, his heart is in it, right? He's been touched by this whale story, and he is compelled to find it. So he undertakes this major filmic project, right? He's got to get a crew together. Not only does he have to get a crew together to shoot the thing, he needs all these scientists to help him find
it.
Yeah,
right.
And they only
have
so much
money. This is when I went to the refrigerator and made a sandwich, because it's not interesting to me.
No, but the premise of it is interesting, because he only has so much time and so much money to do it.
Right, he has a couple weeks.
And can you find this needle in this haystack, right?
Yeah.
So it sounds exciting at the outset.
It does.
Right? And then there's not a whole lot to go on.
And you hit on my point exactly. There's no story here. There is a story, but it's not much of a story.
But you're banking on the storytelling itself.
Look, can't you have a whale upend their boat or something? Can't you do it? Can't you give me a little excitement in this?
He tries. They try to delve into a little bit of the history of the whaling industry.
They fail.
Greenpeace.
Yeah, I know you would think.
Yeah.
So it is ironic that it
Here's the other thing. All the people in it, like, that's the other thing sometimes that saves a documentary like this, the characters.
They
have
no interesting.
Oh my God, these guys are all right. One of them looks like a less interesting version of Sam Waterston. He's not doing it.
And they
there's
can't
no
even,
romance. Yeah, there's no
they can't even
sex.
Have a Blake Lively, you know, on the crew. Can't they even plant one in there? Don't these people do stuff like this? So I got an idea now that we like story with our documentaries.
Well, I think, you know, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, story is what compels us as spectators of film to keep watching.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And what I like about Bourdain, about Roadrunner, is...
And what is the story there? Is there a story there?
Well, it's a story of his life, of his celebrity, of his life as a celebrity. That's, to me, what it is.
Okay.
I got a real good feeling of what it means to be a mega celebrity, such as he. And it doesn't make any difference if it's food or whatever it is. It's just he. People adore him. Cameras are on him all the time. How does he react? Pretty well, considering the attention that he's getting.
Yeah.
And then when it ends up that way, your questioning is it that actress who left him?
Yeah.
Is that the reason? Was he brokenhearted?
Or humiliated in
because
some way?
Because we as human are...
I think he might have exposed his inner self in an embarrassing way to her. This is my theory.
Ah.
And that it led him down a dark path, but I don't know. There was, though, I do want to talk about, if we're talking about the story of his celebrity.
Yeah,
there's a moment in the movie that was really revealing, and it's when the husband and wife producing team decide that they want to make a documentary with him, or you know they want to do this travelogue thing. So they take him, I think it's to Japan or somewhere, and they said it was really awkward. And he was very silent. And they were like, oh no, we've just invested all this money in this concept. And our lead, our star, is kind of AWOL here, emotionally or intellectually, right? He just wasn't
feeling it. Yeah, yeah.
And I think what they sort of allude to is that he had this idea in his mind, having watched documentaries and, you know, travelogue shows before, that he had to be a certain way, that he had to be, you know, like a typical host.
Yeah.
And as soon as he cracked the nut of that,
yeah,
that his take would be breaking those rules,
right,
and those foundations,
yeah,
that opened him up, and that was the beginning of what the world came to know and love as Anthony Bourdain.
Yeah.
Because he was like, oh, you mean I don't have to do that? I can be this way? And it sort of cracked the nut of his on-camera persona.
Yeah.
And that really sort of opened up that whole world of who he was.
And I think that he finally figured out that he could be the Indiana Jones of food, that he could be this wisecracking, self-centered, mm-hmm, robust, bigger than life, a celebrity. And I think he rather enjoyed it until it became too complicated for him. Now, that there's no way of knowing it, right,
mm-hmm,
of why he commits suicide. But it is a fascinating underpinning of that movie. And it strikes me that in documentaries, I really like a point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Not Michael Moore,
okay,
who's skewered liberal point of view.
Okay.
You just look at it and say, yeah, Michael, you know, Columbine and all this. You've got your particular point of view. But when you take something like my favorite of all documentaries,
mm-hmm,
Night and Fog.
Oh, geez. Wow,
do you remember?
That's a heavy one.
Yeah. So you remember it.
I know of it.
Yeah, sure. That's about the concentration camps.
Marcel Ofuls. Who is this?
No. Good one.
Night and Fog. René.
Alain René. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So when you take something like that, it's about the concentration camps,
mm-hmm,
and when it's done so low-key, when it's done with a narrator who is barely alive, he doesn't even express enthusiasm, I'm completely enamored of this. I think I've got a feeling for it. There's something with a point of view. The point of view is, of course, this was an atrocity, and I'm going to present it to you in a way where I don't embellish it. I just let it be what it is. And it takes care of itself. And whereas Koyaanisqatsi, if you remember those.
I do.
And those are the juxtaposing.
Those are more like picturesque, just like.
They're beautiful, but there's a constant statement about what we're doing to the environment,
mm-hmm,
and what the natural environment is. And it'll juxtapose, for instance, a plane going over a platform across a highway in L.A., and then you'll have a shot of the Grand Canyon or something, peaceful, quiet, the mighty.
It's like an immersive experience.
Oh, yeah.
Is that really a documentary?
Well,
or is it only a documentary in as much as it's not fiction?
Oh, man. The big question in documentaries for me is, do you show all sides? Or are you like Michael Moore, just showing one side? All right. Now I like.
So that's interesting, because what you're saying, what you're getting at, is that a documentary might be something other than a nonfiction film.
Yeah.
Like a nonfiction film could be any of these Michael Moore movies.
Yes.
Or,
yeah.
Or Koyaanisqatsi. Yeah. That a documentary has a point of view.
Yeah.
Right. And it is in search of a truth, maybe.
Yes. Yes, I think that's why story is so important to me, and that's why I see it kind of blending into the goals of fiction.
Okay.
Only this is real, and that, what a genius this is. For instance, what about March of the Penguins?
Yeah.
What a documentary. Does it fulfill my need for story? Well, it does when I see what it takes for them to have children, to go out for months to get food and come back. And
they do build this hardship narrative.
They do. Exactly. It, right? Yes, it is.
That's what we need a lot of times, is this hook.
Yes.
Right? Some sort of narrative hook. One of the best documentaries I've seen, and the only reason I bring it up is because now I'm curious where it falls in this line. It's called Becoming Bond. Have you heard of this
No.
movie? It's the story of George Lazenby.
Yeah.
He played James Bond once
in
1969, right? In between Connery and Roger Moore. And this guy was this Australian just knockabout, right?
Huh.
And he got just miraculously, through a series of events, was cast as James Bond. The documentary just sits George Lazenby down in front of a camera. He's dressed in a tuxedo.
Oh, I love to see.
Yeah. He's just sitting there, and you hear the documentarian off camera just asking him questions. Yeah. As Lazenby unfolds and tells his life story, they intersperse these reenactments using a young actor, an Australian actor, and it is a comedy. It's definitely played as a romantic comedy, and it ends up being this extraordinarily charming, funny movie. And you start responding to the reenactments as though it's its own film. I've never seen anything like it, but I'm not sure where it ends up on this spectrum of documentaries. You know, you're definitely compelled by a story, and there's a central love story. You got to see this movie.
Well, a good documentarian could almost leave the camera and let his subject go on while just feeding him a few. I think you've hit the heart of what I like. I like story, but I like it authentic. I don't know this one that came out. I know if our intern, Jacob, could respond to this, and you've probably never seen it, Hoop Dreams.
Oh, yeah, you should see Hoop Dreams.
1994.
You know it?
About basketball kids in the kids, I think, in the ghetto, becoming great basketball
players. It was one of the first documentaries to be nominated for Best Picture outside of the documentary category, right?
This guy's weird. Where do you get this stuff? How do you know that? I've got a list of 20 here, and you out of there, you pick out the most obscure.
A wealth of knowledge.
It is true. But let me intercede here. One of the ones I really like is Michael Apted's Up.
Oh, the Up series. Yeah.
And it started in 64, where you take every 7 years or so.
Seven Up.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I think you're right. But it's 7 years.
It's this group of people every...
Yeah, they follow them through maturity.
Several years.
And there's a case where Apted allegedly is showing them just the way they are, lets them talk to the camera, but it always seems to me that he has something in mind about the growth of human beings.
Yeah.
And so underneath it, there is always something to pull it together. It's just not laying your camera down.
Right. We can't talk about documentaries, I don't think, without talking about Earl Morris.
Oh, Grey Gardens, right?
No, not Grey Gardens. No. Well, boy, there's too many to name. The Thin Blue Line was kind of put him on the map.
I think he does it. The one I'm thinking about is the one about the old ladies in the mansion.
Yeah, that's not him.
That's not him?
No, Grey Gardens is not him.
All right, okay.
He did do a movie called, I think it's called Heaven... Oh, what is it? Gates of Heaven, which precedes The Thin Blue Line, and is really about how people are obsessed with their pets and how they deal with the loss of their pets.
Yeah.
And before that, he did a movie called Vernon, Florida, which is just a bizarre profile of these people in this small town that he just happened to stumble upon en route to a different location. And him and his crew stopped there and they were just mesmerized by these strange people who seem to have just plopped down from a different planet.
Yeah.
You know, but he went on to direct so many.
Yeah, he did.
He's still making them. I can't remember what the last film he made was. I think he did one with Steve Bannon, where he's
opposite,
you know, Steve Bannon.
Well, how would you fit this one in, then, according to our discussion?
Which?
The one I'm about to tell you.
Yeah.
Won't You Be My Neighbor?
Mm. Where would I put it? Well, doesn't it fit somewhere along the lines of the Bourdain documentary? I mean, there are these profiles of lives, of great lives.
Mr. Rogers, how could it not be sweet, right?
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, is it his purpose to show how sweet Mr. Rogers was? And did he, as a documentarian, present all sides of Mr. Rogers? Mr. Rogers couldn't be that saintly.
Isn't that the enduring surprise of Mr. Rogers?
I know it is.
Is that he wouldn't want to be called saintly, but that he worked very hard at being as good a human being as he could, maybe? And that seems like sainthood to us.
Yeah, this is good. I have one that I always remember, and it may not fit anything that we've talked about for documentaries.
Okay.
Man on a Wire.
Yeah, remember.
This is a guy who goes between the buildings in New York, between the towers.
That story has a terrible ending. No towers.
I'm thinking about him. He made it through,
right? No, he did. I'm just saying.
I know. And I'm wondering on that one, as I'm trying to think back, were there, besides being hundreds of feet above the ground, is there anything story-like, tension-like in that to satisfy our requirements?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I feel like that movie goes into the, it's been a while and I've only seen
yeah,
it once.
Yeah, me too.
But it definitely sort of explores why he wanted to do that and the lead up, the build up to it, the execution of
yes.
it. I mean, it does have a built in kind of narrative.
It
and
does.
Does he pull it off?
Yeah.
You know, what happens afterwards?
And you know what intrigues me is that, like our Bourdain, trying to understand why they do something, the documentary purports to do it, and I'll get out of a documentary, and I still don't know why does that guy threaten his own life by walking across a wire?
Yeah.
And you're so right. The expectation is when you go to the film, I'm going to understand now why he's such a wacko to do that, but I can't.
Yeah.
You know, in the end, the documentarian can't get as close, maybe, as they could with Lazenby.
And so that, and now you've just posed a question for another show. Where does cinematic truth begin and
oh,
end? Can
oh,
you find
oh,
it?
I'm
Can
ready
it ever
for that
be captured?
One. There isn't any.
Right? So you get no closer to the truth with a documentary than you
don't.
Do with
exactly.
a work
or
of
let's
fictional
just say
art.
You don't get the answers. But
you get answers.
Right, the truth was
not the answers.
But I think you're right. That is a great question as to how much truth does a documentarian give you, or how much of it of that person's own truth are you getting?
Maybe any filmmaker foolish enough to pursue the truth
yes!
is a whale calling out at humanity at 52 hertz.
Oh, I hope that's the end of our show. That's a good way to end it.
That's it.